I'm Kurt Anderson, and today in Studio 360, we're checking out what's happening, really happening, in Japan today. Most of us have an idea of Japanese-ness in design. Simplicity, subtlety, meticulous craftsmanship, like paper walls and tatami mats and black lacquered bowls. But maybe that's just our cliched Western idea. What would you say is distinctively Japanese in Japanese design?
I wish you would tell me.
That is Tokujin Yoshioka. He is a big-time designer of dreamy interiors and objects like solid glass chairs that look like they're made of ice.
If I explain with cooking, I can use tofu as an example. When you first see it, it's just a simple square white thing. You don't even know if it's cuisine or not. But within that simple square, there's already been a lot of preparation done. The outcome is a quite simple form, but once you taste it, these other processes in its production reveal themselves.
So, Japanese things look simple and beautifully composed because there is so much careful planning involved. But tell that to anybody trying to navigate Tokyo. And not just tourists, even locals can't make sense of the jumble of streets here. It seems so inefficient, so unharmonious, not at all what I think of as Japanese.
The very important characteristic of Tokyo is city of changing. So we are constantly changing.
Yoshiharu Tsukamoto is a partner in the up-and-coming architecture firm Atelier Bow Wow. He designs ingenious buildings in the nooks and crannies of jam-packed Tokyo, such as his own house, a very contemporary living and working space of wood and glass. Each floor is just one room, but they're open one to the next and staggered to maximize the building's tiny footprint. His deck overlooks the old neighborhood.
You see different era, different time, different social condition, different notion of the family, different economical situation in different era. And because in this 85 years, Japanese society changed a lot, and construction techniques changed a lot, material changed a lot. So those three generations built almost like a different city. But it is overlaid in one place.
He took me out for a walk to see how that overlaying works.
Okay, let's go this way. I think it's more interesting.
His street is only 12 feet wide.
If you see those buildings, one and that building, they were built, I guess, in 50s.
Right.
So I think they are second generation of house. Oh, that is first generation?
Oh, this little one-story wooden house?
Yeah, little one-story house.
With a tile, traditional tile roof?
Yeah.
Now, when would that have been built?
I think it's before war.
I would think, yeah.
Yeah, it's built in 30s and 40s. Because this area didn't have damage by war.
Oh, this is gorgeous.
Yeah.
Wow. So we're overlooking 20 feet below us, 30 feet below us, a cemetery.
Yeah.
Which in its form looks like a modern city. There are lots of little skyscrapers, right? It looks like a model of a city. Completely.
My grandparents was living in traditional Japanese house. My parents' house was a mixture between Western and Japanese. And for our generations, traditional Japanese tatami space became more like a symbol. It's not very the efficient space anymore.
Shigeru Ban is one of Japan's star architects.
Within three generations, lifestyle is totally changing. So that the lifestyle of Japanese people is very flexible.
That means designers can be flexible too. Shigeru's most famous buildings are made partly out of big, stiff paper tubes. And he says there's another thing that lets Japanese architects innovate so freely.
In Japan, we have a much smaller liability problem here, so we can be very experimental.
Because it's not so litigious, you can experiment more as an architect.
Yeah, we don't see each other, so that people accept a more experimental, innovative thing here.
Without worrying about an unhappy client coming after you in the courts.
Yeah, exactly.
I went to visit a woman named Reiko Sudo, who founded a textile company called Nuno. She turns improbable materials like metals and plastics into these amazing, luxurious fabrics.
Lately, I've been working with silk mill. Uh-huh. And I will show you some of the raw material of silk.
Okay.
And which is the shell of the cocoon.
Really?
Yeah. This is kibiso, we call it.
Reiko has an advantage working in a country that's very high tech, but which still nurtures craftsmanship and small-scale manufacturing.
So how do you feel?
Wow. It's almost like a plant material. It's like something you'd make a broom of or something, you know? I mean, it feels like a plant.
Yeah. Yes, yes. This is like actually skin of the...
This is the waste skin material?
Yeah, yeah. Waste material. And normally, silk industry didn't use this one.
It's very stiff. Right?
Yes, very, very stiff. And I thought maybe we could work with more casual look or...
Right.
Look at this hat.
This hat. Wow, that's great. But so you would never think of this as silk. This is a funky
right.
hat.
That's right.
And so when you went, you were walking around your silk factory and you saw this stuff in the corner, and you said, oh, I want that. Did they think you were crazy?
Well, they said, are you serious?
Yeah.
Are you going to use this one? And I said, yes, why not? I just wanted to try.
Well, show me some other materials. This is fantastic.
Another of her fabrics looks and feels like silk, but when you ball it up in your fist, it holds the shape almost exactly, like some kind of fabric from the future.
Huh.
And this is telephone wire out of copper.
Little, yes. Little tiny, fine copper wire.
Yes, it's a telephone wire.
And this very soft, subtle sort of coppery pink color is the color of the wire.
The color of the wire.
That's fantastic.
Isn't it nice
color? Yeah. I'm not a big fan of pink, but this is fantastic.
But you have to be careful to go through the custom.
Oh, yeah. The airline security would not like this, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
When Reiko founded her company, Nuno, 25 years ago, a woman running her own business was almost unheard of. And it's still rare.
I think I actually felt some insecure feeling at the time.
Uh-huh.
Because, when I started, I only hired women.
Why do you think that was? Because you wanted to give women an opportunity or because you'd rather just keep boys out of it?
Just keep. And I don't want to, I think in Japanese sense, if I'm hiring boy, then I have to look after this boy forever. But for women, I can maybe like, that's
interesting.
Old style Japanese behavior.
Uh-huh.
Sorry.
No, it's interesting. You can take the girl out of feudal Japan, but you can't take the feudal Japan out of the girl, I guess.
Yes. Some of my staff were saying, like, you are so tough to me, like the girl, like a lady. But for the boys, I'm so nice. I'm too nice.
Yeah. You have a child as well.
Yes, boy.
Yeah.
One boy.
There you go. Do you find any difficulty balancing the entrepreneurial designer life with being a mother?
Very difficult.
Yeah.
I have some kind of like images as a mother, like as a head of company. Lately, lots of dinner always my husband make, and I still feel so guilty. Oh no, I had to make dinner for my family.
Uh-huh.
But look at my boy, he doesn't care. Uh-huh. Oh, I'm lucky because she's not home and I can do anything I want, but I feel so, oh no, I had to do it.
Because you're not living up to the image of the perfect mother?
Yes, yeah. Japanese woman has to do everything.
Yeah.
So even when Japan looks so cutting edge in so many ways, the past still has this very strong hold. Talk to a modern artist, a modern with a capital M artist, and you get the sense of how often what they do is rooted in traditional practice, like meditation.
I sit in front of my computer and try to empty myself and wait.
Shuntaro Tanakawa is Japan's most famous living poet.
And then some word emerging from beneath of my foot. Like a plant, I put my foot as a root to Japanese language soil, so I can suck the kind of juice, nutrients from Japanese language. And I try to make a flower.
In his poem, A Night Radio, Tanakawa writes about his childhood passion for tinkering with old radios.
夜のラジオ。ハンダゴテを手に、僕は1949年製のフィルコのラジオをいじっている。
A night radio. I'm holding a soldering iron, tinkering with a 49 Philco. Despite warm tubes, the radio is stubbornly silent, but its odor, still fresh, mesmerizes me. Why do ears wish to hear beyond their capacity? I think we hear much too much nowadays, and I feel nostalgic over this broken radio's silence. I can't say which is the more important to me, tinkering with a radio or writing a poem. I long for the days when I had nothing to do with poems and walked those dusty childhood roads. But I've forgotten about women and friends as though time did not exist. I just wanted to hear, should have heard, something more. My breath held, my ear cocked, in every summer's towering clouds, in the muttering of family get-togethers in an untidy room, refusing to compress living into a story.
生きることを物語に要約してしまうことに逆らって。
Shuntaro Tanakawa, along with his translator William Elliot. After rushing around Tokyo for days and days, I left in search of Tanakawa's dusty roads and stubborn silence. Three trains, a ferry boat, and 5 hours later, I arrive in Naoshima, a tiny island in Japan's inland sea. A billionaire businessman turned this little fishing island into a contemporary art complex. Its jewel is a small museum that contains just a few pieces by three artists, including one artist whose medium is light. I sit on a stone bench in an empty 25-foot-high room, and for a long time, I don't know really how long, stare up at a frame piece of sky. Clouds float past. The light shifts slightly. One moment, the blue rectangle looks perfectly flat, and the next, it stretches out to infinity. This experience, totally futuristic and totally timeless, on a barren little island in the middle of nowhere, seemed to me perfectly Japanese. But this work of art, it was created by the artist James Turrell, an American, kind of a cowboy, actually, from Arizona. Even as Japan has become outwardly more like the West, it seems as if globalization works both ways. The rest of the world is becoming a bit more Japanese. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. We've got all kinds of photos and videos from our trip to Japan at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can subscribe to our free weekly podcasts of the show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Rob Weisberg,
Catherine Epstein,
Kurt Schlachter,
Josie Holtzman,
Nick Haling.
Special thanks to Junko Takeuchi, the voice of the anime character Naruto. Thanks also to Ken Marks, Chris Bannon, Amy Bussum, Alex Villari, Anna Boyko-Wyrock, Ralph Samuelson, Yoko Shioya, David Janes, Matthew Kavner, and Katsuo Kawamura. And an especially deep bow of gratitude to David DeHealy and Shizu Yuasa.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360 in Japan is supported in part by the Freeman Foundation and the United States Japan Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.